Let's look into a little. I shouldn't be wordy. If there was Mahasattva Fu was here, or Master Chi, or any other of the great masters, they would cut me down for saying anything. But let's try to prize open this kunan, this exemplary communication. So I've told you about Fu and Wu and Chi, but what about the sutra? That plays a part in this communication. What about the Vajracchedaka, Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom that cuts like a diamond, that smashes like a thunderbolt? What of that? For Chinese Chan, this sutra is probably the most celebrated, the most important of all, especially in early Chan. The sutra, which of course came from India, is regarded as the word of the Buddha, and was read and recited and studied by the early Chan masters. Some of them recommended its recitation as the main practice. The main practice is reciting the Diamond Sutra and sitting in meditation. Sometimes you get the impression when you read Chan and Zen literature that it's anti-text. Zen and Chan is anti-text and anti-sutra. This isn't actually so. Sutras and texts are not to be turned into dry academic study. A lot of the time when you get a kind of iconoclasm in relation to texts and sutras, the Chinese masters are attacking the kind of literati, which was a whole class in Chinese society. They're attacking the literati. They regarded sutra reading and text reading not as a way of adding to knowledge, but you read in order to intuit reality. There's a whole notion in this kind of Buddhism of reality reading. When you read a sutra, you do reality reading. You're not trying to nut it out. You're not just skimming. You read to intuit reality. You read with spiritual intuition. Indeed, the Diamond Sutra came to be employed as the means by which the Chan master would transmit the Dharma to his disciple directly, mind to mind. In the story of Hui Neng, this is many years after Mahasattva Fu, the sixth patriarch, who was an illiterate woodcutter, when he hears the Diamond Sutra just being recited by somebody, he awakens. Later, when he's studying and practicing with Hung Jen, which seems to consist in him doing a lot of rice pounding and, you know, working in the kitchen. When Hung Jen takes him in private to his quarters at night, the patriarch hands on the mind transmission of the Dharma, the mind of enlightenment, to Hui Neng by reciting the Diamond Sutra. When Hung Jen came to the lines from the Diamond Sutra, a bodhisattva should produce an unsupported mind, a mind unsupported by sights, unsupported by sounds, unsupported by smells, unsupported by tastes, touchables, or even by the mind itself. A bodhisattva should produce a mind unsupported by mind. When Hui Neng heard this, he was fully awakened. So the Diamond Sutra is hugely important for early Chan and Zen. But what does it teach? What does the Diamond Sutra teach? You get perhaps a glimpse from that little verse of what it might teach. But let's just try to say a little bit more. The Diamond Sutra is about how to practice the Dharma. It's about how to live the Dharma. It's actually a book about living. Particularly, it's about how a bodhisattva practices the Dharma, how a bodhisattva lives. In this sutra, the Buddha teaches those people who have dedicated themselves to enlightenment for the benefit of all. He teaches them how they enter into the path and how they should view and regard whatever arises on that path, how they should view other people, how they should engage in different practices, how they should view great beings, how they should cultivate and view different states of mind, how they should view and practice in relation to all experience whatsoever. That's what the Diamond Sutra teaches. And at the beginning, the Buddha tells the basic attitude, teaches the basic attitude. So he says, someone who's set out on the path of the Bodhisattva, that is, gaining enlightenment for all beings, someone who's set out on that path should produce, should create, should invoke in his being an incredible, it's not a thought, an incredible, I don't know what you call it, mind, will, an energy, should invoke in his being what's called the bodhicitta, the enlightenment heart. He, in other words, he produces an aspiration to gain enlightenment for every single kind of being there is throughout the entire cosmos. And the Buddha goes right through all the different kinds of possible being there is, from the smallest microbe right up to the most refined level of consciousness of all. The Bodhisattva forms this intention, I will lead them all into nirvana. I will lead them all to a place where they find peace. But, the Buddha says, he also has the thought, that's not the right word, although all beings are led into nirvana, no being exists. No being is led into nirvana. If the Bodhisattva sees beings as existing, as leading beings into nirvana, he is not a Bodhisattva, yet he leads all beings into nirvana. He really does lead people, he really does relate to people, teach them, help them out. But no being exists. All beings apparently are there, and they're not there. Later the Buddha talks about a particular practice of a Bodhisattva, probably the most important practice, that of giving or generosity. The Bodhisattva is the supreme giver. If you want to make any progress in spiritual life, you need to become a greatly generous person. A Bodhisattva gives money, food, clothing, time, energy, gives himself, gives the Dharma, the liberating teaching, like Mahasattva Phu. He's totally involved in the welfare of others. To give like this, of course, he has to practice all the other perfections, as they're called, all the other practices. He has to practice ethics, patience, need a lot of patience, vigor, meditation, needs to practice wisdom as well. But the Buddha says, the Bodhisattva gives without any support, any sign. He's not supported by sights and smells. He's not supported by mind. In fact, there's no notion of giving. There's no notion of self, of other, of gift given. But he gives continuously. So he's giving, but there's no notion of giving. Later, the Buddha talks about the great attainment. He talks about the attainment of stream entry, the one that we all want, where you're irreversible from enlightenment, where you've got that one-way ticket to nirvana. You're not coming back. You're just on that stream. I know a lot of people get worked up about this. What can I do for stream entry? Because we all want to be saved. So we're very concerned about this. But the Buddha says a stream entrant, a true stream entrant, doesn't regard himself as having attained anything. That's why he's a stream entrant. If he had a notion of attaining anything, he wouldn't be a stream entrant. So it goes on like this. So you have to try and imagine this, try and imagine a teaching like this. Imagine you're sitting with the Buddha and you come in and you sit down to meditate. And he says quite strongly to you, and because he's your teacher and the Buddha, you have great feeling for him. And his every word, he tells you strongly to meditate on the breath, to really apply yourself to your breath and to your practice. But then he says, and realize that there is no breath and there's no one breathing. That's why it's breathing, because there is no breathing. Well, imagine that. It really would have a very powerful effect.